This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Humans and elephants have coexisted for millennia in the Malay Peninsula. And for his dissertation, Dr. Lim Teck Win from the Management and Ecology of Malaysian Elephants Project studied human-elephant relations from both social and ecological perspectives. In particular, he examined the intertwined histories of humans and elephants in Belum Temenggor by exploring the history of elephants, the history of the people, and the history of the relationship between humans and elephants in this area. So in conjunction with both the International Day of the World's Indigenous People on August the 9th and ahead of World Elephant Day on August the 12th, Teck Win joins me now to share his findings and to offer some strategic suggestions in approaching elephant conservation in Malaysia. Welcome, Teck Win. How are you today?
I am great, Juliet. Thanks.
Before we get into your research, maybe you could just help explain first to people why elephants play such a crucial role in the ecosystem and why they are known as a keystone species.
Right. Well, many Malaysians don't realize that we have elephants in Malaysia. And those who do realize that normally think of elephants as animals that are only found in like really remote places, like in the middle of Taman Negara. But not so long ago, in fact, less than 100 years ago, there were elephants in Kuala Lumpur, in Damansara, roaming around what is now Petaling Jaya. And in those days, they played a very important role in forest ecosystem in this part of the world, in this part of the country, in that they would spread the seeds of large fruited trees, such as durian, and they would move around the forest. And the most important thing, actually, is that the rainforest can be very dense, like the undergrowth can be covered with rattan, and it can be very hard to move around. But when you have herds of elephants that actually move around, they open up trails, and that actually makes the forest more livable, more accessible for people to move around in the forest. And so they're kind of like this, even though they're so such big creatures, they also play a very big role in terms of ecology in the ways I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And I think another thing is people don't realize, or people don't care about their conservation so much because, you know, they don't see them as much, right? And what would you say, you know, is a good reason that we should care about their conservation wherever they are in Malaysia?
Well, there are two ways of looking at this. You could say that they're important from the ecological point of view, and you can stress how the forest would be very different. There'd be very different types of trees living in the forest when you don't have elephants. In fact, in places where elephants have gone extinct, the forest nature changes. A lot of palms come in, many of the fruit trees no longer get dispersed, and so they die out in that area. Mm-hmm. So the forest is just a different ecosystem when it doesn't have these large mammals such as elephants in it. I would say that rather than to look at the problem from a strictly kind of scientific point of view, I would say most people would feel that something almost spiritual, in that they feel that the elephants have a right to exist themselves, and they feel good just knowing that there are still elephants in the wild.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, the focus of your research for your PhD was on the conservation of Asian elephants, but by examining the case of human-elephant relations in Peninsular Malaysia from both ecological but also cultural perspectives. So why did you choose this as the focus of your PhD? I mean, you know, maybe you could help explain what your research objectives were.
Right. Yeah, well, to take a step back, when I was given a scholarship from the Sime Darby Foundation, and the topic that was given to me was human-elephant conflict in Peninsular Malaysia. Mm-hmm. But when I started looking into it, I decided I didn't really want to do my PhD on something so negative, or at least something framed in such a negative way as conflict. Mm-hmm. And so I took a step back and said, all right, let's look at this problem from a broader perspective and look, instead of looking at just the conflict, look at the relationship between people and elephants in the peninsula. And so that answers why there's conflict today, but it also offers some hope for what I call a convivial relationship, you know, a good a relationship without, not so much without conflict, but a relationship which is manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's such a lovely, fresh approach because, you know, anywhere you look, it's always human-elephant conflict. There's never the word coexistence, which is something I think that you found, you thought was very important.
Yeah, well, it's a tendency generally with the human-wildlife relationship is that often we focus on the negative aspects. Mm. For example, most people who live in the city, if they have any kind of interaction with wild animals, it can be negative, like there are pests, like cockroaches and rats and so on.
Right.
But then the positive aspects are equally important. Like if we think about the greenery, the flowers, the birds and so on. And that traditionally, if we look in the past, this was all part of one big picture and we wouldn't kind of separate these things out. We wouldn't separate humans from nature. Mm. But if we are to examine how we fit in with nature, we need to look at the positives as well as the negatives and literally come to a complete picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bigger picture as such.
So
you also wanted to compare present-day attitudes towards elephants between different indigenous communities in Peninsula Malaysia and also to identify the cultural factors that influence these attitudes. Why was that? Why was that a particular objective of yours?
Right. One of the crucial things to whether or not we will have elephants in future in Malaysia is the extent to which we are able to tolerate a certain amount of conflict. And so they're kind of like two potential futures for having elephants in Malaysia. One is that all of the elephants are locked up and put in zoos or put in these so-called sanctuaries.
Mm.
And that would be a shame because then the elephants would no longer be playing the ecological role I mentioned. And there's also this kind of, I think we really look at animals very differently when we know they're in captivity compared to the kind of magic of them continuing to play their natural role in the ecosystem in the wild.
Mm.
So if we're going to continue to have elephants in the wild, then we look at the interface between elephants and people because elephants are never going to be entirely content staying in the deepest parts of the jungle. They will always tend to come to the edge of the jungle, edge of the forest, and that's when they will come into contact with people. And it's also a recipe for conflict if those people are doing things which will result in elephants either attacking them, attacking their crops, attacking their homes, and so on. So the question is, what I realized is that there have actually been people, orang asli, living in the peninsula for more than 50,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually quite a long relationship. So I figured out if we can learn from how the orang asli kind of lived together with the elephants, then perhaps we can appreciate better how to live with elephants in the modern world. The other thing I realized is that there are different groups of, not just orang asli, but different groups of people in the peninsula practicing different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And even among the orang asli themselves, there are some groups which were farmers, but some groups were foragers and they didn't plant crops. And that kind of opened the door to the idea that perhaps it is the groups that planted crops that are somehow less tolerant of elephants.
Mm.
So I wanted to look at that question. And I also wanted to look at the question as to the attitudes towards elephants, the attitudes towards conflict among people who are living in cities. And so these kind of perspectives would then give a better clue as to how best to conserve elephants on a kind of a national level in future.
Okay, I'm speaking today to Dr. Lim Teck Win. He is from the Management and Ecology of Malaysian Elephants Project. And we're discussing his research, you know, in discovering how human and elephant relations can be better improved. And we're going to dissect his dissertation after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. On the line with me today is Dr. Lim Teck Win. He is from the Management and Ecology of Malaysian Elephants Project, and we are discussing the findings from his PhD, which focused on nurturing human-elephant coexistence. So before the break, Teck Win, we were talking about, you know, all the different objectives of your research. So now let's, you know, dig right into it. So you said that understanding the present dynamics of human-wildlife interaction, that required examining how the relationship has developed since prehistoric times, which I think is why you wanted to look particularly at, you know, how the orang asli coexisted with elephants. Tell me a little bit about your approach to discover more on this.
Right. Well, what I decided to do is to interview several different groups of orang asli. Some of the orang asli were traditionally foragers, that's meaning hunting and gathering, not really planting any crops. And then I'd also interview another group of orang asli, the ones that were what is known as Sweden farmers. They would plant things like paddy bukit, that's hill rice, mm-hmm. and cassava, and crops like that on a, for a subsistence basis, basically for their own food. And I also decided to interview some other farmers planting more kind of cash crops and longer-term crops, such as rubber, and oil palm. And I want to see the kind of like different reactions or the different problems that these groups faced mm-hmm. when it came to elephants.
Okay. And, you know, you devoted a whole chapter to the ecological relationship between humans and elephants in the forest environment. And, you know, a word that popped up to me was ethno-elephantology. Could you help explain that concept to me?
Yeah, I actually didn't know that term before I started my research. But what it is that it looks at the relationship between people and elephants. So it's a study of people and elephants. And it fits in with the broader idea of ethnobiology, which is just the relationship, the traditional relationship between people and biology more generally. And you probably will have heard of some of the subsets, such as ethnobotany,
yes.
how people traditionally use plants. And this, well, ethno-elephantology is like a subset of ethnozoology, specifically to do with elephants. And the idea that you have this kind of almost a discipline emerging gives you a kind of a clue that there is a really deep relationship. And it's not just a relationship in Malaysia, it's a relationship which has actually been evolving over hundreds of thousands of years throughout the world, including in Europe and in North America. Mm-hmm. Most people forget that early humans and elephants lived side by side in Europe. In fact, if you think back to movies such as the Ice Age, then you have the kind of like caveman hunting the woolly mammoth.
That's right. Yeah.
And similarly in North America, there were these mastodons, really giant elephants that are now all extinct. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing about Malaysia is, unlike in Europe, unlike in the Americas, the people and elephants managed to coexist without the elephants ending up extinct. In fact, it's not just in Europe and North America that the elephants went extinct. It's also many parts of Asia as well. Mm. In fact, there were elephants found throughout China until the Chinese became, the Chinese civilization expanded. And as basically over the last 500 years, the elephants have gradually been retreating from the northern part of China, and now they're only found just in the southern part, just in the tip of the southern part of China.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay. And, you know, just going on that, you know, you also wrote that one of the most fundamental ecological principles is the quote unquote competitive exclusion principle. So maybe you could help elaborate on that and also how it relates to human and elephant coexistence.
Yeah, so the competitive exclusion principle comes from basic ecology, and it's the idea that if two species compete for resources, then in the long term, one of them will outcompete the other, and then it kind of displaced the other. So in one location, only one of those species will actually survive, and the other will be excluded.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I had in my mind when I was reading the literature, it said that people and elephants were, well, some of the references said that people and elephants were complete competitors, or like perfect competitors, and that only when there were people in a landscape, then the elephants would be pushed out.
Mm.
Similarly, interestingly enough, in certain parts of Africa, the fact that there were elephants in the landscape meant that civilizations could not progress, because whenever anyone tried to plant any crops, the elephants would come and destroy it. And so that is one of the theories why civilizations did not manage really to establish a firm foothold in Africa until the elephants were extinguished. For example, in ancient Egypt, the elephants were actually all hunted out before the ancient Egyptian civilization managed to emerge along the Nile.
Mm.
And so if you look at it from that perspective, it's quite interesting how actually in places such as Peninsular Malaysia, there was no exclusion of the elephants, in the sense that the people, the ancestors of the early Orang Asli and elephants both managed to live in the same landscapes, in the same forests in the peninsula for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. So basically what has changed now, right?
Yeah, well, I also wondered how that happened, or how it could be that the people and elephants managed to live in the same landscape.
Mm.
And so what I found was two things. One is that, well, to begin with, they're usually not literally one on top of the other, in the sense that elephants and people originally lived at very low densities in the forest, maybe only one person per square kilometer, and less for elephants. So, you know, they would also be moving around, and so it would be kind of rare for them to bump into an elephant in the forest. However, there are certain times of the year when they would be seeking out the same source of food, such as during the durian season, they would all gather around the durian trees and there'd be a race to see who could get the durian out as they fell up from the tree.
Right.
And so, of course, that's a very dangerous situation for people to be in when you have a herd of elephants and you're trying to fight for durian. And so what I found is that the Orang Asli, and this is most groups of Orang Asli, during such seasons when they were in the same area as elephants, they would spend the night in the trees. They would often build tree houses.
Mm.
So I found that fascinating for several reasons. One, it meant that they could literally live on top of the elephant and still survive. And so there are kind of stories from early literature of when they heard the durian fall, then they would run down from their treehouse, go and grab the durian, and then bring it back up to the treehouse.
Wow.
And as long as the treehouse was built high enough, then they would be safe from animals such as tigers and elephants.
So those are very adaptive measures that they obviously studied and came to that conclusion. This is the best way that we can coexist with, you know, all the different wildlife, especially elephants.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would use the word study. I would say it's a culture that evolved.
Uh-huh, okay.
And this was very interesting for me as well, because, you know, we often look down, people who live in cities, they often look down at people who live in trees, and we tend to say, oh, they're like monkeys, you know, they don't even know how to, they haven't yet come down from the trees.
Mm.
But when you think of it from the perspective of living in the same landscape as elephants, then it all makes sense. You know, it's not that they're somehow backwards. It's they have realized that this is the best, their culture has kind of evolved to become the most appropriate culture for living in a landscape with elephants.
And I would say that, I would argue that also it shows a respect for the animals as well.
Oh, absolutely. And which is interesting as well, because if you talk to them about elephants, and this is not just the Orang Asli, this is all the main native groups in the peninsula, including the rural communities of Malays, they all have a very deep respect for elephants, and they refer to them as Dato, Orang Besar, Orang Kuat, and they will, they actually have a pantang larang, a taboo against referring to the elephant in any kind of negative way and saying something like, saying the word gajah, for example.
Oh, why is that?
They have a belief, many groups have a belief that if you say, oh, this terrible elephant came and like knocked down my crops or knocked down my house, or you, or if you, they say also if you chuck up basar, you know, if you kind of like boast and you, then you mention the elephant, then somehow they believe the elephant will hear you and they will come and target you and they will come and, wreak some kind of reprisal against you. So it's absolutely a very respectful attitude towards the elephants, because of course they respect their strength, but it also seems to be a respect for them that in many of these groups it goes into almost a spiritual dimension, in that there's often a taboo against eating elephant meat, and certainly a taboo against hunting elephants among many of these traditional rural communities.
And, you know, if they were to come into conflict, to use that word, you know, if they were to come into conflict, I imagine that killing is not the first option.
Yeah, so this was one of the main focuses for my study, as you imagine. We wanted to know, would these rural communities feel that the conflict was so bad that they need to kill the elephant, or would they call the wildlife department to come and kill the elephant, or call the wildlife department to translocate the elephant, relocate it away from their village, or would they be somehow accepting of having the elephant around? And what I found, my results are quite mixed, in that there were some groups, and these groups tend to be the ones who lived in larger communities and the ones that planted more of these cash crops. They would, they were also ones experiencing the most conflict, in that some of them had elephants coming almost every night. So they lived in fear of the elephants. Mm-hmm. And some of them had family members killed by elephants.
Of course.
So Right. Not surprisingly, these were the groups that they felt that, what they told me is that sometimes if an elephant really gets out of control, and like they've warned the elephants many times, then they would resort to setting a trap to kill the elephant. And some of these groups, these are the kind of the groups of Orang Asli that are known as the Senoi or Tamia. Mm-hmm. And not all of them, but some of the ones I interviewed, they said that, yeah, well, when you had one problem individual, they would identify that individual and then they would set a trap for let's call him him. And then that individual would be killed and eaten. But not everyone would eat elephant meat, but there were some of these communities that traditionally they said, yes, they would eat elephant meat, but only as a kind of a last resort. And it's not the kind of animal that they would hunt to eat, mm-hmm. but it would be like as a result of killing a conflict animal. And that, when that happened, yeah, there would be enough meat for several villages for several weeks.
I can imagine, yeah. So it was more a practical thing to do rather than, you know, it was not necessary, it was more a practical thing to do to eat the elephant meat.
Yeah, it was not out of necessity. It was not something that they were forced, it just happened that after they killed the elephant, then they had all of this meat and they wouldn't let it go to waste. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there were many other groups. For example, the Malay communities, they believe it's, I don't think it's actually haram, mm-hmm. but it's something that they would avoid. There's something about the fact that elephant has got tusks that mean that it's almost like a predator. And I think the Quran or the Hadith says that you're not supposed to eat the meat of such animals. And among many of the other groups of the Orang Asli, they said they believe that the elephants have human souls and therefore they wouldn't wouldn't eat the meat of these animals. But a lot of the people I interviewed as well, they just said, no, it's not their preference. They wouldn't want to eat elephant meat.
Okay. All right. And I just want to move on to another chunk of your thesis, which is on the history of human-elephant relationships, particularly in Belum Temenggo. Why did you choose to focus on this particular area? And what were some of your findings, you know, from this particular part of your research?
Right. Well, Belum Temenggo in the northern part of Perak, it's right on the border with Thailand. It's fascinating because it's for many reasons. One, it's still got a lot of pristine forests. It's some of the forests have been turned into totally protected areas, such as the Royal Belum State Park. And also, it is home to many groups of Orang Asli. In fact, you have the group known as the Johai, and they're in the northern part of the Belum area. And then you've got the group known as the Temia, and they're in the south. And the Johai were these kind of traditionally hunter-gatherer communities, and the Temia were traditionally Sweden agriculturalists. They kind of like planted rice and so on. But the Johai didn't really plant anything. They were more moving around, semi-nomadic, and surviving off these yams that they found in the forest. And so I wanted to study the differences between the groups, and Belum Temenggo was a good landscape because not only it had these different groups, but it had a lot of elephants, and the elephants were causing a significant amount of conflict. So I set that as my main study site, and the findings there were, I think, quite applicable for the rest of the country, in that what I found is that a lot of the conflict was due to the fact that the Orang Asli were planting cash crops such as rubber, which traditionally they would not have planted. And the reason they were planting rubber is because they were encouraged to do that by the government. In fact, the government was giving them free rubber seedlings and encouraging them to settle down, set up rubber plantations. And
I see.
This was often the course of the conflict, because when the elephants came along and saw these rubber trees, and interestingly enough that the elephants actually do strip the bark of the mature rubber trees, and they will trample on and eat the young rubber seedlings. Uh-huh. And so in one evening, a herd of elephants can wipe out a village's rubber plantings. And so a lot of their labor or investment and time can just be evaporated. And you can imagine that is a cause of a lot of the conflict.
And that, I guess, you said stopped them from planting certain types of crops as well. I mean, that was something that I read, that the presence of elephants that actually influenced their choice of crops, you know, stopping them from doing subsistence crops. Am I correct?
Well, it gets back to this idea of that we think of people who live in trees as being primitive or backwards and somehow unable to come up to the modern standards. But these group of Orang Asli is the ones which were kind of traditionally nomadic, such as the Johai. They were originally thought of as being backward in some way or primitive. Mm. But you can see that one of the reasons that they did not plant or settle down in villages in the middle of the jungle is because of these large problems created by elephants, not just elephants, but large animals in general, including tigers. So if they settled down in the middle of the forest and had something like goats and maybe a rubber plantation, that really doesn't last for very long.
I can imagine.
You know, the tigers and the elephants have different ideas. And so similarly, when we as a nation, we want to set aside part of Malaysia as a totally protected area for wildlife, then we cannot expect the people living next to these Taman Negara or inside the Royal Belum to suddenly adopt ways of life which are not compatible with having tigers and elephants as neighbors.
Yeah, it's a policy that, you know, is not all encompassing and doesn't actually take into account all the different stakeholders as such.
Yeah, well, it's not just a policy; it's a whole mindset. It's quite short-sighted. The mindset that we are better than your honesty, we are modern, we are advanced, we are civilized, and therefore, well, we want to help out the Orangasli, and we can help them out by bringing them into the modern world, by encouraging them to settle down, giving them permanent houses, giving them rubber seedlings so they can have a source of income from rubber. So a lot of these policies are well-intentioned, but they are short-sighted, and I think as a root is the kind of lack of respect of the fact that these cultures are not really, the Orangasli follow these kinds of ways of life, not because they're unable to get with the modern times and learn these kind of tricks of agriculture or learn the technology of settling down in one place. It's not that they're unable to do these things. It's more of the case that their culture has evolved to realize, I say realize, but I use that in the sense of kind of the respect that their culture has for the natural environment and the way it has adapted over these tens of thousands of years. And so it's the Orangasli are absolutely capable of understanding the technology of housing, the technology of agriculture. But as is shown again and again, when they attempt to implement it in areas which are remote in the middle of the rainforest and surrounded by elephants and tigers, it's shown not to be suitable, not because they're unable to, it's from like the mental or physical unable to, it's because the context, the ecology, the environment doesn't let them.
And, you know, another government scheme that you said didn't quite work out was, or that you examined, was the scheme to protect villagers from elephants using electric fences. And maybe you can just walk me through some of your findings on that.
Right. Well, in order to address this, I think we take a step back and look back to the 1950s, 60s and 70s, when agriculture really started to convert a lot of the rainforest in the peninsula. And at that time, the level of conflict was huge in that there were many herds of elephants in places, particularly in Perak, which were regularly coming out and destroying these new rubber plantations and oil palm plantations. Mm-hmm. And so the response of the government, the wildlife department at that time, was to shoot these so-called problem animals. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that was heartbreaking, but at the same time, it was quite unacceptable for many people in the public who wanted to save the elephants, or from conservation perspective, or maybe from an animal rights perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was actually quite a tremendous achievement that the Wildlife Department found an alternative means of dealing with wildlife conflict. And that was, instead of shooting the animals, they came up with a method that was, they learned from mahouts in India, to catch the elephants and move them, so-called translocation program, move them away from the problem agricultural hotspots and put them into protected areas such as Tamnagara or Royal Bloom. Mm-hmm. So that kind of sounded really nice, you know. But as the years went on, and more studies have shown that this translocation doesn't really solve the problem so much as shift the problem to somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Because the Orangasli living in Bloom Tumungo, they were not happy with having all of these so-called problem elephants moved into their backyard. Yeah, then it kind of causes conflict, increases conflict for them.
That's right.
And so that was, it's still probably better than shooting the elephants, but translocation is certainly not a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all the problems, and it can cause more problems. So what the Wildlife Department in recent years has been focusing on, and this is something that the MEME program supports, is the idea of living in the same landscape as elephants. And in order to achieve that, the crops and people can be protected from elephants by using electric fences. Mm. And these electric fences don't actually kill the elephant or any animal that touches it. It just delivers a sharp shock, which it's a way of kind of like teaching the elephant that it's a bad idea to cross that fence. Mm-hmm. And so in theory, what would happen is that any of the crops that are protected by the fence would be able to grow to a size in which they no longer need protection. And when it comes to palm plantations and rubber plantations, it's about after 5 or 6 years, the plants are often big enough that the damage, if any, from the elephants would be quite minimal. Mm. And so that could be a win-win in that you can have elephants in the same landscape as agriculture. However, you asked about my study of these electric fences in Bulum Tumungo. Mm. And unfortunately, the results there have been more mixed in that the fence that I looked at was really quite an extensive fence. It was something like 7 kilometers encircling an Orang Asli resettlement scheme, which was quite a big area. And there were problems with maintaining the fence, and particularly where the fence crossed the road. There's a logging road that went right through the fence. And I mean, it's a bit technical, but they had these things like a spring gate. But so the logging, like the lorry driver would need to come down, open the spring gate, drive through, and then close it after him. And for one reason or another, the spring gates didn't last for very long. Mm-hmm. And then the elephants actually entered through the spring gates. Because there was a gap in the fence where the road went.
Of course.
And then, I mean, this is quite tragic, but some of the elephants got then trapped inside the fence. And you can imagine how much damage they could cause if they were trapped inside the fence, couldn't get out.
Okay.
I think the fencing is absolutely a scheme that should be applauded. And so it's certainly a very important way of living in the same landscape as elephants. And it's something that MEME, as I mentioned, really is encouraging. However, there are lessons that need to be learned on how the fences can be maintained. And that's still quite a challenge, especially when you have these logging roads going through the area you want to fence off.
Yeah, and just to kind of conclude, you've noted that without interventions, there is a tendency for elephants to be eliminated, especially as human population density passed a critical threshold. And you've suggested a strategic phases approach to interventions that can be made, to avert such a scenario and instead promote the conservation of elephants. Could you briefly walk me through some of those?
Yeah, well, this is a good thing to end on because it's actually I am quite optimistic and my findings were quite positive. In that what I found is that even though the population of Malaysia as a whole has been increasing tremendously, the amount of conflict per capita, has been coming down. So the amount of conflict we're having with elephants as a proportion of the number of Malaysians, it is a lot less. And that's simply due to the fact that most Malaysians now live in cities. And so we never actually come into contact with elephants. And so that has some of the positive benefits because it means that we city folk don't have this negative reaction to elephants because we haven't experienced elephant raiding firsthand. And so that means that at least in theory, the city folk get all the benefits from the idea of being proud of having wild elephants in our country. And at the same time, we don't have to suffer the downside. So what I would hope is that the people in the city would then somehow be able to subsidize the elephant management control measures for people who live in rural areas, the ones like the Orang Asli who bear the brunt of the impact of having elephants in their landscape. And that, in a way, to a certain extent, we do that in that our taxes go to pay for the federal government and programs such as the Bailey-Tan Electric Fence Program. And this is really, there's real potential in Malaysia, unlike many other parts of the elephant range, such as India or Sri Lanka, where there are still so many rural people coming into direct conflict with the elephant. But in Malaysia, it's the number of people who live in these landscapes that come into direct conflict with the elephants are really quite, it's really quite small proportion of the total population. And as long as we have large enough areas for elephants, wild elephants to roam, such as the Royal Bulum and the adjacent landscapes, such as the forest reserves in Temenggor and in Taman Negara, then, and at the same time, as long as we kind of like, as a nation, come together and say, okay, we're going to tolerate a certain amount of conflict, and the people who are living in these urban folk, like myself, and we would then be able to subsidize the fact that we benefit from having wild elephants in the country. So if we do that, then I'm really quite optimistic that there is a future for wild elephants in Malaysia.
Okay, well, that's hopeful to hear. You know, I mean, we've been hearing so much bad news about tigers, for example. So it's nice that you, after all your research, you know, are still so optimistic about it and quite positive about that, that some changes can be made. But thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Lim Teck Win. He is from the Management and Ecology of Malaysian Elephants Project. And we were discussing his thesis, which looked at nurturing human-elephant coexistence. And if you missed any part of today's interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.